By remote, this is BOA News. I'm Michael Brown. President Donald Trump is back at the White House after visiting Kenosha, Wisconsin, the epicenter of the latest protests over racial injustice. Protests erupted last week after a white police officer shot a black man, Jacob Blake, 7 times in the back as officers tried to arrest him. President Trump did not mention Blake's name during public comments Tuesday on his visit, saying only he felt terribly for anyone who suffered a loss, but otherwise only noted that the situation was complicated and under investigation. The president toured destruction left by rioters in Kenosha, declaring it was enabled by Democratic leaders. Trump also promised $1 million in funds to Kenosha police and an additional $4 million to help small businesses damaged or destroyed there. On the eve of his visit, the president defended a teenage supporter of his, accused of fatally shooting 2 men at a demonstration in Kenosha last week, and accused Democrat Joe Biden of siding with the rioters in the unrest. Election Day, 9 weeks away here in the U.S., and former President Biden holding on to his months-long lead over President Trump in nationwide polling, but surveys show the race has narrowed and even closer in key battleground states that are likely to determine the outcome. The U.S. decides the presidency through an indirect form of democracy, not by the national popular vote, but in an electoral college where the winner in each state receives all of the state's electoral votes. Each state's number of electoral votes is based on its population. Trump and Biden are scheduled to debate each other 3 times, once later this month and twice in October. For more news, join us, BOANews.com, via remote. This is BOA News. Cuban authorities launched a 15-day lockdown in Havana Tuesday to halt the low but persistent spread of the new coronavirus in the capital city. Aggressive anti-virus measures, including airport closures, have virtually eliminated COVID-19 in Cuba, except in the capital, where cases have increased from a handful a day to dozens a day over the past month. Havana now has a 7 p.m. to 5 a.m. curfew. Many stores are barred from selling to shoppers from outside the immediate neighborhood in order to prevent people from moving around the city. Some Havana residents complain that the measures were complicating the already difficult task of buying food in a city stricken by constant shortages and endless lines for a limited supply of basic goods. The strongest typhoon of the year is on the way to the Korean Peninsula Wednesday. After lashing Japan with strong winds and rain, Typhoon Maisik, a Category 4 storm on the 5-level scale, could affect weather as far away as Canada. Maisik is expected to make landfall Wednesday in South Korea as a Category 1 or possibly Category 2 storm. Here in the U.S., Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin said Tuesday a second massive round of aid addressing the economic impact of the coronavirus pandemic is still needed, even as the U.S. economy is showing signs of recovery. Mnuchin's testimony before the House Select Committee on the Coronavirus comes as talks for a second round of aid have remained stalled on Capitol Hill since the first round of federal unemployment benefits to millions of out-of-work Americans expired in late July. Mnuchin said that the numbers of unemployed Americans had not reached a threshold of 40 million, as many analysts had initially predicted. Congressman James Clyburn, who was the chair of the Select Committee, differed with Mnuchin on the unemployment numbers, saying that 29 million Americans were receiving or waiting for unemployment benefits as of August 1st. He also warned that signs of recovery in the stock market did not benefit all Americans. And the Brazilian city of Niterói in the Rio de Janeiro state has begun testing a coronavirus vaccine produced by the Chinese pharmaceutical company Sinovac. The trial is being conducted by a partnership between the city government of the Butantan Institute and the Oswaldo Cruz Foundation. For more news, as always, we invite you to join us at our website. That is BOANews.com or the BOA mobile app. Via remote, I'm Michael Brown, BOA News. We'll be right back.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, September the 2nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Guinean President Alpha Condé accepts to run for a third term.
There is a new constitution in Guinea since March 22nd vote, and based on that new constitution, it's a new republic that is starting. So if it's a new republic starting, the president can present himself for a new election.
A new film on rape is launched in Liberia. Uganda's poor face the brunt of COVID-19 school closures. The UN appeals for help as Sudan suffers its worst flooding in a century. And Malawi's president reinstates a dismissed army chief.
As commander-in-chief, vested with powers of appointment, it was improper to use such powers without cause. I have therefore redeployed General Nundwe back to the position of commander of the Malawi Defense Force with immediate effect.
Botswana hopes its mysterious elephant deaths are over. And a Senegalese singer wants to build Akon City near Dakar. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. President Alpha Condé of Guinea has officially accepted his party's nomination to seek a third term. Guineans voted on March 22nd this year in a controversial constitutional referendum that the opposition said was intended to illegally make possible a third term for President Condé. The National Front for the Defense of the Constitution in Guinea embarked on nationwide protests to disrupt the referendum. The Guinean government refuted opposition allegations that more than 21 people were killed during the protest. President Condé's decision follows that of neighboring Ivory Coast President Alassane Ouattara to seek a third term and a protest in Mali followed by a military coup. Information Minister Amara Sampare says the reality of Guinea is different from that of Mali and Cote d'Ivoire.
It has been made official yesterday by a press release from the RPG Arc-en-Ciel, the party on power.
As you know, Mr. Minister, the opposition has said that the president's decision to run for a third term is in violation of the constitution.
There is a new constitution in Guinea since March 22nd vote, and based on that new constitution, it's a new republic that is starting. So if it's a new republic starting, the president can present himself for a new election.
Of course, the opposition was against the change in the constitution.
Yeah, they were. But the fact is that referendum has been made and the population has voted yes for the new constitution. And it's now a law for the republic.
Given what has happened in Cote d'Ivoire and Mali, and many people are concerned that government leaders like your president are changing now, trying to stay in power.
There is a concern from certain persons, that is obvious. But the reality of Guinea is different from Cote d'Ivoire, is different from Mali. And I think every people has its sovereignty.
If he's running for third term, what is he promising to do for the people of Guinea?
You will be aware of that on time because the campaign hasn't started yet. Once the campaign starts, the program of the president will be published and explained to the people. Now we're just waiting the closing dates for the candidate to submit their candidature. And after that, the Electoral Commission will publish a list of candidates based on what the Constitutional Court has validated. And then the campaign will start for the presidential election.
What is it that he wants to do for the people of Guinea that he did not do in the first two terms?
You will discover it very soon.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Jen. Amara Sampare is Guinea's information minister. He was speaking with us from the capital, Conakry. The issue of rape in Liberia took center stage last week with three consecutive days of protest attended by former Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf and Nobel laureate Lema Bowi. President George Weah said his administration has been concerned about rape. Now, the Kids Engagement Education Project has launched a new film to put the focus on not just rape, but also on family molestation and abuse. Brenda Brewer-Moore is the executive director of the new film, Keep. She says there has been over 900 reported cases in the last 5 months, resulting in just 20 convictions.
The film comes on the heels of the first one we did in 2018. And again, it's another tool that we're using to create awareness around rape. Not just awareness, but also provide a tool that parents and community members can use to have conversations with their children or family members around rape and sexual molestation, which is an issue here in Liberia.
Brenda, the issue of rape took center stage last week in Liberia with three consecutive days of protest. How serious is the issue of rape now in Liberia?
It is an issue of concern. And personally, one of the things I've said over and over is that we declare a state of emergency in Liberia when we had only one or two cases of coronavirus. The entire country was shut down. Schools were closed. You know, I mean, everything, curfew enforced, et cetera. We've had over 900 reported cases in the last 4 or 5 months. And out of that, you've only had about 20 convictions. You have a lot of the cases not really materializing into anything concrete. Majority of the cases, I believe I saw somewhere 60% of the 900 cases have been perpetrated against children, you know, children under the age of 18. So this has really caused a lot of concern. There have been a lot of, you know, conversations around it, a lot of anger in the communities. You know, people who are alleged rapists are let go by the police. The system is, you know, poorly funded in a way that allows a lot of loopholes for people to get away with crimes. And so what happened in 3 days protest or campaign really was a call to action to the government to do more and declare rape a national emergency and to bring this issue on the forefront.
Do you think that enough is being done to tackle the issue of rape in Liberia?
More needs to be done. I don't think enough is being done. You have people going to the police. One of the things that we've mentioned repeatedly is around support to the police and the different airports around the country. A family will go and make a complaint of, you know, alleged rape or whatever to their on their child or their family member. And then the police are not providing logistics that they need to even go and arrest. So most times when a family go and makes a complaint, the burden falls back on the family to transport police officers to go and make arrests or even to follow up. The system is such that there's a lot of back and forth that in the, you know, in the process, people get discouraged and saying, nothing's going to come out of this. I might as well just try to treat my child. There are cases of people going to the one-stop centers that have been established and there are no medication there. There are no rape kits, etc. So more needs to be done.
How prevalent is molestation in Liberia?
It's very prevalent, and a lot of times people don't talk about it because, again, it's usually committed by a family member or close friend of the family. Personally, it was one of the reasons why I came out with my story in 2017, and the intent really was to bring out this topic because it happens a lot in our society. We condone it, you know, but we don't talk about it. So it's very pervasive. And I was very surprised, actually, when I came out with my story of being molested as a child, just the sheer number of people that came out and said, you know, explained how they themselves had been or they know somebody who had been. And sitting in a room with women and you're having conversation, you just realize just how many persons in that room had been molested as a child. So it is something that is pervasive, and it takes all of us to start to push and change this narrative, you know, having conversations with our boys, having conversations with our brothers, you know, to stop this act.
Thank you very much for making the time to talk with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Buddy.
Brenda Brewer-Moore is the executive director of a new film about rape in Liberia. She was speaking with us from the capital, Monrovia. Malawi President Lazarus Chakwera has fired the army chief and replaced him with the commander who was fired in March by Chakwera's predecessor, former President Peter Mutharika. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
In his live address Tuesday on state broadcaster Malawi Broadcasting Corporation, President Lazarus Chakwera said the sacking of General Vincent Nundwe was not procedural.
Although the former president had ultimate responsibility for the Malawi Defense Force as commander-in-chief and was vested with powers of appointment, it was improper to use such powers without cause. I have therefore redeployed General Nundwe back to the position of commander of the Malawi Defense Force with immediate effect.
Malawi's former president, Peter Mutharika, fired Nundwe in March for allowing the military to protect demonstrators protesting the results of last year's elections. The Constitutional Court later annulled the elections and called for fresh polls which were won by Chakwera in June of this year. Chakwera said his decision to redeploy Nondwe is to restore justice to the operations of the Malawi Defense Force.
In doing this, my purpose is to heal the injury and injustice of an unfair decision inflicted on our entire military as a professional institution.
Chakwera also has announced he will soon convene a meeting of the Defense Council to discuss the appointment of the new deputy commander of the Malawi Defense Force and other key positions. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Wednesday, September the 2nd. The United Nations says hundreds of thousands of Sudanese affected by what is described as the worst flooding in a century are in desperate need of emergency aid to help them survive this humanitarian disaster. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN appeal comes after torrential rains in Ethiopia over the last few days triggered severe flooding downstream in Sudan. The floodwaters have caused the Nile River to reach the highest level in 100 years. The consequences are catastrophic. The Sudanese government reports at least 90 people have been killed and 380,000 affected across the country. It says nearly 80,000 homes have been destroyed and damaged, rendering hundreds of thousands of people homeless. In addition, 34 schools and nearly 2,700 health facilities have been put out of commission. Spokesman for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Jens Laerke, says the crisis is unfolding as the coronavirus spreads across the country.
Access to clean water, critical in the middle of the COVID-19 pandemic, has also been affected. Some 2,000 water sources are contaminated or non-functional, according to initial assessments. In Khartoum, now in a state of emergency, the immediate need is to shore up the banks of the Nile and provide shelter to the homeless.
On Sunday, the Sudanese government declared a state of emergency in Khartoum State, where more than 21,000 people have been affected by flooding. The World Health Organization reports more than 13,000 cases, including 833 deaths from coronavirus in Sudan. Laerke says UN and private aid agencies are providing emergency shelter, household supplies, food, water, health services, and other essential relief to flood survivors across the country.
A quick response has been possible because the government, UN agencies, and our partners had pre-positioned supplies to respond to the needs of 250,000 people before the rain started. But these stocks are being depleted rapidly.
Laerke says the UN and other agencies do not have enough money to meet the needs of the growing number of flood-affected people and is appealing for more support from donors. He says the appeal is in addition to the UN Sudan Humanitarian Response Plan for 2020, which was issued earlier in the year. He notes less than 44% of the $1.6 billion requested so far has been received, making a generous response from donors even more critical than before. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
COVID-19 has created a new normal for school children learning by video applications and broadcast channels, including in Uganda. But while many embrace the new normal, not all families are able to afford paying for data or even electricity for the television. Halima Athumani reports from Mukono, Uganda.
Fourteen-year-old Ugandan Musa Sewanyana has mastered the art of bricklaying. He should be in high school laying the foundation of his education. But since Uganda closed schools in March to contain the spread of the novel coronavirus, Sewanyana has few options. He says during the school break, he is still reading his books. If we get money, says Sewanyana, we switch the TV on and follow the teachings. But I also do odd jobs, he says, so I don't spend the whole day at home. Unlike families who are financially able to study online, Sewanyanas cannot always afford the power needed to watch lessons on state TV or the $3 per day subscription. His mother, Naiga Rashida, says the past 5 months have been difficult with her three children at home.
She says they don't have electricity. She had even bought them a new television set, knowing they would use it to study, says Rashida. But there are times when even the solar battery doesn't charge, she says, and the television goes off. The Ugandan government vowed to buy televisions and radios for poor communities with school children, but has yet to act. A $150 million July World Bank grant is expected soon to help provide learning materials for students nationwide. But Uganda's acting director of basic education, Mulindwa Ismail, says the damage is already done, including to school properties that were sold off or sitting vacant.
The chairs, there were some of them were eaten by ants. So by the time we reopen schools, we may need now to replenish, to buy another set of furniture. But that said, the loss of jobs for our teachers and what, losing property, but even losing our learners. We are worried the sensible percentage may not come back to school.
Education charity groups like Uwezo, which means capability in Kiswahili, says COVID-19 has caused both a health and education crisis. When schools eventually reopen, says Uwezo's executive director, Mary Goretti Nakabugo, children will have to make up for lost time.
The starting point will be to try and give a simple assessment to understand the level at which each of these kids is. Otherwise, if you take them as a whole, many of them are going to be left behind. And the ones who are going to be left behind are mainly the ones in the low-income families.
Meanwhile, Uganda's Ministry of Education is planning a campaign aimed at parents to encourage homeschooling. Halima Athmani for VA News, Mukono, Uganda.
Botswana says a string of mysterious elephant deaths came to an end in June when at least 281 carcasses were found, raising hopes that the animals are no longer at risk. The country has the world's largest elephant population. Experts are pointing to a natural toxin as the likely cause of the deaths. Kundise Dube reports from Habaruli.
Botswana's Minister of Wildlife and Environment Permanent Secretary Odwetsi Koboto says it appears the country's elephants are no longer dying from a mystery cause. While close to 300 elephants' carcasses were found earlier this year, with no sign of poaching or predators, the ministry has not found any more since June. Most of the blood samples sent abroad for testing are indicating a toxin as the cause, says Koboto, though it's not yet clear if it is man-made or natural.
We have received most of the results. A lot of variables that we suspected had tested negative. We have ruled out any virus, no bacteria, pathogens also negative. And the only thing that we are waiting for is toxicology. What is evident is that we are now dealing with a poison.
Koboto says officials are waiting on one last batch of test results from the United States before making a final conclusion. Veterinarian Dr. Mbachi Mwazituma says a natural occurring toxin would explain why no more elephants appear to be dying in Botswana's Okavango Panhandle.
In the period leading to June, remember, this is the dry period. The amount of water is in low quantities. Now, because of a naturally occurring toxin, there would be in higher concentrations in the waters, and those elephants that drink in particular spots, they can get affected. Now, with the rising waters of the Okavango in the panhandle over the last couple of weeks, those toxins are then diluted and washed out.
Conservationist Neil Fitt agrees that changes in weather conditions could have diluted a natural toxin.
If it is an environmental toxin, they come and go depending on weather conditions. So obviously the conditions, if that is the case, have now changed. And, you know, that's the reason why the deaths have stopped, which is a good thing. But until we get the results, which are extremely long in coming, we can't say much more.
The Minister of Wildlife and Environment, Koboto, says getting quick results on the investigation and test samples was not possible due to COVID-19 restrictions.
There was lockdowns everywhere, even internationally. Mostly we are dependent on air transport. If there are no flights going even outside the country, just even to South Africa here, how could we have taken them out?
Botswana's neighbor, Zimbabwe, recorded mysterious deaths of at least 11 elephants. Wildlife authorities say the cause appears to be a bacterial infection. The two countries have the world's combined largest elephant population at more than 200,000 animals, most of them in Botswana. Conservationists estimate the number of wild African elephants has dropped by almost a third in the last decade due to drought, loss of habitat, and poaching. Nkondisi Dube for VOA News, Gaborone.
Singer and Senegal native Akon, who spent his childhood between the United States and Senegal, was in Dakar on Monday this week to announce his plans to build Akon City, a proposed $6 billion U.S. dollar project outside the capital. The mixed-use project, which has the support of the government, has drawn both enthusiasm and skepticism from Senegalese architects, business owners, and more. Real estate developer Suleiman Sow spoke to Ricky Stryak about his optimism about the project and the economic development it might bring to Senegal.
What I think about this project, Akon City project, is this project will make the Senegal open a lot of opportunity for the Senegalese people and African people too. About building, everywhere you go around the site who Akon build this project, the price about the lands around there will be up. The price will be go up. Senegal will be the hub, economic hub in the West Africa, because every people who travel to go to Dubai or everywhere around the world, to Europe or United States, they will stay in Africa, because everything what they try to have on the side, they will have it here. Understand?
Yeah. Do you think that what he is promising, though, on this small stretch of land is possible?
Akon is the, Akon is the Senegalese, the son of Senegal people. And then he know the opportunity to develop Africa now. About this project, he have a big team with him. He have a big team with him. He have the good team with him who they know about this kind of project. And then two, this project will call the African people, the black American people, to come back to Africa.
The idea behind it, Akon expressed very well, and that is a very applaudable idea. But the land is only 50 hectares or 2,000 acres. Is it possible to build everything he's promising on this land?
Yeah, he can. He can. He can build everything in this land, because you see the project is how he have a big team with him. They know it's possible to build the oldest building in this land. 15 hectare, you say, is not small, it's big. And then he have a good team with him. They are study this project since a long time. It's not now. They have a time to see the all of possibility to build in this land, and all the Akon towers and the stadium, all those things they can be inside this land.
Have you seen any environmental impact studies that have been done about what kind of impact on the people surrounding Mbojun where they're building it, because they farm there, or it is coastal areas?
No, I don't say I see the study they do with this project, because it's the team, and this team is not open for everybody. We have some people, they need them to know what's happening inside. But one thing is sure, our president, Macky Sall, in Senegal, he never agreed this kind of project when they don't respect the environment.
That was Suleiman Sow, president of the real estate development company, World Trade and Building Immobilier. He was speaking to Ricky Stryer from the Senegalese capital, Dakar. And that's it for this Wednesday, September 2nd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clott, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo, and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. and it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.